Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second case on our Zoom oral argument calendar this morning. Just to reintroduce the panel, my name is Keala Eid. I'm serving as presiding judge today. I'm joined by Judge Harris and Judge Bentley. This is A240402, State of Minnesota versus Stephen Allen Hart. Before I go any further, can I just confirm, counsel for appellant, Mr. McGeaney, are you able to see and hear me okay?
Good morning, Your Honor. I am, and can the court see and hear me?
Yes. And can you see the clock that says 15 minutes?
I can, thank you.
Great. And is it Ms. Os? I'll just ask you to pronounce your name. Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Carrie Osowski, can the court hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Ms. Osowski. And can you see the clock?
Yes, I can.
All right. So just a couple of housekeeping matters. We are obviously streaming this on Zoom. There is an audio recording that's being made of the proceeding that will be available on our website later this afternoon or tomorrow. That is the only recording that is to be made of this proceeding. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal, and counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes for your argument. When you begin, please just state your name for the record and who you represent, and then let us know how you'd like us to refer to you, Mr. McGeaney, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Your Honor, thank you and good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim McGeaney. I'm the attorney for appellant Stephen Hart in this appeal from a criminal conviction and sentence out of Olmstead County District Court. Your Honor, there are three issues raised on appeal today, and there's also the, I'll call it minor issue of my motion to strike respondent's addendum. I won't address that. Unless time permits, I'll get to that on rebuttal. I'd like to start off with just outlining the three issues in order that we believe are most persuasive. One is the what appellant considers the district court's imposition of a harsher sentence based on his decision to proceed to trial in this matter rather than entertain a guilty plea. The second issue is whether the district court abused its discretion in prohibiting one of appellant's witnesses, who was referred to in the pretrial motions as an expert witness, and to offer some opinion about the situation, specifically the testimony sought by appellant from that witness was regarding what's commonly known as the Tula drill or the 21-foot distance that the victim had to appellant. I would concede that it was appropriate to prohibit any testimony by that expert witness regarding whether appellant acted in self-defense or any other legal conclusions. But I think it was clear in the argument at the pretrial hearing that the important testimony appellant was seeking to have introduced through that witness was the Tula drill theory about someone being able to close the 21-foot gap in a matter of seconds. And then the final issue on appeal was the district court's denial of appellant's motion or request, I'll call it, to continue the trial after the state filed the untimely, I would call late, motion to exclude Mr. Garber, the expert witness's testimony. Those are the three issues that were argued on in our briefing, and those are the three issues that are before the court. Regarding the denial of the motion to continue, I think that's probably intertwined with the court's decision to exclude Mr. Garber's expert opinion regarding the 21-foot distance. It's our position that that late notice did not give trial counsel. I was not trial counsel in this case. It did not give trial counsel adequate time to prepare an argument for the district court regarding why that expert testimony was relevant and should have been included. And
Mr. McGeaney,
I
can
would.
I just ask you a quick question about that? Do you have
Yes.
any, I understand you weren't trial counsel, but do you have any understanding as to what arguments they would have made
Because I understand they filed a brief and had oral argument. What was, even to the extent that it was that it was error, which I'm, setting that aside, what was the prejudice to your client because of the continuance?
Your Honor, certainly, Your Honor, thank you. And it's in the pretrial transcript around pages 39 through 44. But essentially, defense counsel wanted to elicit the testimony about the 21-foot distance. I think it was probably not disputed that the alleged, well, the victim at this point was within 21 feet, even closer to Mr. Hart at the time Mr. Hart used deadly force on him. And so the evidence that the defense was seeking to get in through that witness was that it's a known training fact in firearms training and use of force training that someone within 21 feet can close the distance between themselves and you faster than you can draw a firearm and fire and shoot it. It's commonly called the Tooler drill, and that's the evidence that was being sought to introduce. Mr. Hart was prejudiced because the jury was unable to hear from a use of force expert. Not that the use of force was appropriate, but that Mr. Hart didn't have a reasonable grounds to retreat. Minnesota being a duty to retreat state, that one line of testimony or that one little piece of evidence would have been relevant for the jury, for the jurors to conclude, or at least in the defense's opinion, that Mr. Hart did not have a reasonable grounds to retreat because the victim was so close to him, and that's what the expert was going to testify to. Again, I
Oh, I
concede the other.
guess just one more clarifying question about that, about your position. As I understand the respondent's position, and certainly we'll get her view on that in a moment, it is that there was a dispute as to whether the victim here was bolting, starting to move, or standing still. Is it your view, does the 21-foot rule make a difference whether he was standing still or moving? So is that fact question relevant to the expert testimony at all?
That's a good question. I think every fact is relevant, but I don't think it's particularly dispositive of the 21-foot rule. In other words, the Tooler drill teaches people taking that firearms training that someone standing still within 21 feet, not with, could then approach you in less time than it would take you to draw your firearm and fire it. So they wouldn't necessarily have to get a running start. So I don't know that particular piece of evidence is that relevant? I don't know. Again, we think that the jury should have heard that and then been able to decide, use that evidence to make that determination about whether Mr. Hart had a reasonable grounds to retreat. I know,
Here's my
and
concern. Can I just jump in here? I understand you've argued that this was a constitutional error. It interfered with his ability to his constitutional right to present his defense, right? So that would implicate harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in terms of prejudice. So why isn't the expert's testimony cumulative of your client's testimony? He himself testified during his concealed carry training that he learned about. He didn't say 21 feet, he said 20 feet, but he basically said the same thing, right? And so tell me why we shouldn't conclude that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because he basically said the same thing that Mr. Garber was going to say.
And I agree, he did say 20 feet instead of 21, probably in a nervousness of but it's a foot difference. I think that the reason that Mr. Garber's testimony would have been helpful to the trier of fact is that, as in every criminal case, the witness's credibility is at issue. There was, the fact questions, the disputed facts about whether the victim was charging him or whether he was standing still. There was the ultimate question discussed in pretrial whether Mr. Hart was the aggressor, the initial aggressor, and whether the victim was the initial aggressor. So to hear from a third person to corroborate Mr. Hart's assertion that yes, this is the training I received, and this is what the experts in the field of self-defense and use of force have taught me, it would have corroborated Mr. Hart's testimony, because everything Mr. Hart's going to testify to is being drawn into question as whether it's credible or not. He's the defendant on trial. So that would be why we think that particular witness's testimony would have been helpful to the triers of fact, and that it was prejudicial to disallow it. And again, I would concede some of the other testimony from Mr. Garber probably not admissible, but that one particular piece we believe prejudiced Mr. Hart in being excluded.
Can we even say that this interfered with his constitutional right to present a defense when he actually got a self-defense instruction and the exact information? I mean, I'm not trying to ask the cumulative question twice, but to
I
get
understand.
that higher standard, I mean, I'm just wondering if it really is an issue that presents an error of constitutional nature. Because he got the self-defense instruction. This isn't like a case where he didn't get to argue alternative perpetrator or he didn't get the instruction at all. And it wasn't as though, there's no record made that his sole decision to testify was based on giving this 20-foot information or 21-foot, however you want to put it. So how, to get to harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, how can we be sure this was an error of constitutional nature?
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that because he did get the instruction, then the burden shifted to him to be able to present evidence that he did act reasonably in self-defense. One of the elements of self-defense is that he did not have a reasonable grounds to retreat. So it impinged on his right to present a complete defense and present evidence corroborating his position that he did not have a grounds to reasonably retreat. That's why we believe it's a constitutional error, because the burden was on him and the court impinged on his ability to carry his burden of proof, or his burden of persuasion as well. I'm running out of time quickly. I appreciate there are multiple issues in this case. I would like to address what I believe was a more blatant, I guess, or more obvious error by the district court in sentencing. And the argument we're making here, Your Honors, is that the district court basically imposed an executed sentence on Mr. Hart rather than depart because he went to trial. I understand the state's brief. They argue he didn't get a more serious sentence because he didn't get the statutory maximum. Well, he didn't get the guidelines maximum, that he could have got more than 90 months. But it's our position that the more serious sentence is not in the number of months that were imposed, but in the disposition, not necessarily the duration. I'll rest mostly on my brief because I have about 3 minutes left. I'm sure you have questions. But I think it's really telling that the district court basically tipped her hat and said, hey, if you had taken a deal, I would have departed. Right? This was a case that was ripe for departure, but you chose to go to trial.
But counsel, I read the statement, and the statement is, again, the court did indicate that the parties could have reached an agreement, but you went to trial. Could one interpret that to say one of the departure factors, or the departure factors are specific to the defendant, and one of those factors is whether or not he showed some type of remorse? Could one interpret that statement to say that I had the opportunity at trial to see you when the victim was testifying? I had an opportunity to watch you throughout the trial, and that information helped me make a determination that you didn't reach or meet one of those factors, that being that you didn't show a remorse or you didn't have a sufficient amount of remorse, and that is the basis for the departure. Is that a reasonable way to interpret that statement? Because again, I agree with you, that statement's very specific. Is this really a question of how we interpret the statement of the court?
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate that. I would argue no. I think that to use the decision to go to trial as the, I'll call it the evidence or the showing that you're not remorseful is inappropriate. If that were the case, then any defendant who exercised their constitutional right to trial is not remorseful. And so it's kind of a catch-all.
But
And there was
counsel,
evidence of
but to respond, I guess the question is, it's not that the action in going to trial is why the court determined that the defendant was not remorseful. It was the defendant's behavior and actions that the court was able to observe during trial that helped, again, inform
I'm asking, is this a reasonable interpretation? Help the court inform its decision as to whether or not to grant or deny a departure in this case.
Again, I would argue no. I don't know that there's any specific actions of Mr. Hart in the record that would, he did in the sentencing submissions in the psychological evaluation, he clearly showed remorse. He apologized, and to continue to assert that you didn't, Mr. Hart never denied shooting this young man, right? He never denied shooting. His position was always that I did this because I was fearful that this young man was coming at me with a knife. And the only factual dispute really was whether Mr. Hart was the aggressor or the victim was the aggressor, right? The jurors made that determination that Mr. Hart was the aggressor and therefore not eligible for self-defense. But merely as continuing to assert that I acted in self-defense and that I didn't do anything wrong, I think, is not the kind of evidence that someone's displaying a trial that would show a lack of remorse that could be used for that purpose, that the court's implying that to go on a trial
Sorry,
and maintaining
sorry to
innocence is not.
interrupt. I know you're close on time. I just have a quick kind of follow-up question on this point, which is a couple pages. So looking at the transcript of the sentencing, a couple pages after the language that we've been talking about when she compared, mentions like if you had taken a plea or shown some responsibility, later on the court says, I would have liked to see more empathy for this court, even after trial, even after seeing the things I had to see. I wanted to believe you might gain some insight. So I didn't put you in custody right away. I gave you the opportunity to work with your attorneys. That's to me, signals that there was room after trial, despite the lack of a guilty plea, to show some kind of responsibility or remorse, and the court didn't see it. Is, even if the language earlier is a little more suspect, I mean, does that not point to the fact that the court, didn't actually make that wasn't a defining or deciding factor in the departure? And hopefully you can finish the question, Judge Eade, if you
I
don't
know I'm
mind.
out of time, but if I
Yeah,
may
go
answer the
ahead,
question,
please.
Your Honor.
Please.
I think that the it's the same as the answer to Judge Harris's question. Mr. Hart, post-trial, continued to assert his belief that he had acted in self-defense. And so it's just an extension of his continuing to say, I don't think I did anything wrong. He did express remorse. He apologized in the transcript. He apologized in his psychological evaluation. I think the district court was looking for him to come out and say, all right, I admit it. I wasn't acting in self-defense. I did something wrong. And so he's being punished for continuing to assert his belief that he acted appropriately. I don't know that that's grounds to say he's not remorseful. I think it's just a continuation of the frustration the district court had in having to try this case rather than have it resolved with a plea. And I see I'm out of time, so I appreciate the court's questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGeaney. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Osowski, Assistant Olmsted County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. The court did not abuse its discretion in any of the decisions reached at the district court level. And I want to start with the final issue that Mr. McGeaney addressed in his argument, which is the sentence that was imposed by Judge Hayne. That was a sentence of an executed 90 months, 4 months above the middle of the box sentence of 86 months. It's the state's position that Judge Hayne did not punish Hart for exercising his right to a trial. There's no evidence in the record that Judge Hayne imposed a harsher sentence. There's no evidence that she told Mr. Hart at any point or any of the parties at any point, if Mr. Hart takes a plea deal, I'm going to dispositionally depart. I'm
Well,
not going to sentence.
counsel, you can't say there's no evidence when, again, the statement, if you would have worked with your attorney to fashion some plea agreement where you took responsibility for the crime you committed and showed some least at least some insight into your actions, the court would have been very receptive to you serving a local sentence. Instead, we had a trial. Again, it seems to me to be, how does this court interpret those very specific words from the district court, where it seems to me the district court is saying, you could have, issue, you sh could have gotten a plea deal. And if you did a plea deal, I would have been receptive to a local sentence, a departure, but you went to trial. How does this court, in light of that sentence and that statement, which frames everything, how can we say that the court did not abuse its discretion and, in essence, impose a harsher sentence because Mr. Hart went to trial?
I guess I would compare the present case to State v. Pickett. In that case, before sentencing, well before sentencing, the district court told Mr. Pickett, this is the sentence that you're going to get. He then requested a contested sentencing hearing. And at that point, the district court that's then said, never mind, you're going to get a worse sentence than the maximum sentence I told you you were going to get. In this case, and I apologize for the misstatement, in this case, Judge Hayne didn't say at pretrial, are you sure you don't want to plead guilty? If you plead guilty, I might depart here. But if you go to trial, maybe I won't. There wasn't that advance promise made to Mr. Hart to incentivize him to take a guilty plea and then go back on that promise later at sentencing. I do wish Judge Hayne hadn't made that comment. But she does make other comments later on. I do want to point out to the court that what the state pointed out to the district court and what Judge Hayne also said to Mr. Hart was that remorse is a critical factor, that showing of remorse. Mr. McGinney says that Mr. Hart showed remorse in his written submissions to the court. I don't see that there's much remorse. He submitted a six-sentence letter to the court. His 11-year-old grandson submitted a longer letter to the court than he did. And what he said was, I am sorry for the pain that I have caused to others. I will do my best to avoid conflicts of any kind in the future. He didn't say, I'm sorry for what I did to the victim. He actually, in the psychological evaluation, referred to the victim as homicidal and said, yep, I later learned that he had mental health issues, and that proves that I was justified in how I acted on March 13th of 2022.
Can I jump you ahead to the exclusion of evidence issue? You make an argument in your brief that essentially that the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard doesn't apply because Mr. Hart didn't call Mr. Garber as a witness before Judge Hayne issued a decision on all his proffered testimony. And I'm a little troubled by that because what I understand from the record is that Judge Hayne re reserved a decision specifically only on the testimony of Mr. Garber generally criticizing the investigation. That was the only part that was reserved. And so then in the middle of the trial, the judge then reminds, the district court reminds counsel, I still have this, reserved ruling on this point. And counsel says we're not going to call him at that point. And the judge goes on to say something to the effect of, yes, I think you've crossed the officers enough on that. And the attorney agrees. So the 21-foot issue, which is the focus of Mr. McGinney's argument, is not what the defense declined to call Mr. Garber on. The court had already ruled. And the reason why I say I'm troubled is I can't really imagine a scenario where we would require for someone to preserve this issue. That they have Mr. Garber in the hallway ready to call or call him again once the court has ruled, you can't testify on this point. And that their decision not to call him on a point that's not being argued on appeal is basically fatal to applying the standard of review. Can you address that?
Yes, and I did not mean to apply that the district court's decision, or I guess not the district court's decision, trial attorney's decision not to call Mr. Garber about other issues is fatal to the appeal on the issue of offering expert testimony about the 21-foot rule. And I'll focus just on that since Mr. McGinney acknowledges there shouldn't have been testimony on whether Stephen Hart acted in self-defense. I
Okay,
merely was
so
trying
just
to.
to guide your comments then, since I think we're on the same page now, my concern is, the flip side of the question I asked Mr. McGinney about why isn't it cumulative is, this was evidence from someone with law enforcement training, with significant law enforcement training, as I understand it, that would then go to support the concealed carry training that Mr. Hart had. And then he conducted a experiment of sorts that he would have testified about to further support this idea that goes directly to one of the elements of self-defense. And so, I also, I'd asked Mr. McGinney about harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and whether it applies here, but the closest case that I've found on this is this Zumberge case, where the Supreme Court essentially applied harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in a self-defense matter. And so I'm wondering, why shouldn't we conclude that this was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, not cumulative, given the different nature of what Mr. Garber was going to testify to?
Thank you. There's a two-part answer to your question. First of all, in regards to the training that Mr. Garber has received, as well as the training that Mr. Garber offers, defense counsel at the trial court level said he is going to offer testimony about what a trained law enforcement professional would do in this circumstance when someone is within 21 feet and is armed with a knife and could close that distance within a very short amount of time. Mr. Hart is not a trained law enforcement professional. He's a layperson. So
Same
testimony
training.
about
That's the same training he got at concealed carry, right? I mean, it's basically tracks within a 1 foot difference between 20 foot and 21 feet with what he was told when he got his concealed carry permit.
yes. Which is what Mr. Hart testified to the jury. But again, having an expert testify about law enforcement reactions in a similar situation is not appropriate, especially when, again, Mr. Hart is not a trained law enforcement professional. This is not a trial about an officer who used force. This is about a
Not
layperson.
about the use of force, the reasonableness of the belief that he could not get away in time. That if he was within 21 feet, that an attacker with a knife could close that gap before you could run away. I mean, and there is also in this particular case, it's a 15-year-old victim and then a much older man. So
Yes. And I would point to how trial counsel for the state phrased that issue. The question isn't, can a 15-year-old close the gap between himself and a 66-year-old man that's 21 feet away in a matter of seconds? That's not the question. The question was, did that 15-year-old attempt to close that distance? Did that 15-year-old run at Stephen Hart with a knife in his
Is
hand?
that the question, though? Because, to Judge Bentley's point when she was questioning Mr. McGinney, whether he's lunging or standing stationary, it seems to me that Mr. Garber's testimony is still relevant. And the trial testimony was not 21 feet, right? It was the longest I think it was from any witness was about 8 feet or so. So, it's as I understand it, is once that the testimony, the offer of proof was going to be once that person's within that 21 foot zone, if they're standing at 21 feet, not lunging, then it's reasonable to believe you're not going to get away from a knife wielding assailant. So I don't know why the difference between lunging or stationary really matters in terms of the ability to present a complete defense.
And I would argue that Mr. Hart was able to present a complete defense. The district court simply applied rules of evidence to the proffered expert's testimony and concluded that it would not have been helpful to the trier of fact. I've already kind of stated why. I initially said, Your Honor, that I had a two-part answer to your question. I do want to get to the second part. Please let me know if you'd like me to go back to the first. But regarding that reenactment that Mr. Garber said he completed, defense counsel did provide a reenactment completed by a different individual. And when that exhibit was initially offered, it was discovered by defense counsel's own admission that reenactment was inaccurate. Now, that doesn't mean that Mr. Garber's reenactment would have been inaccurate, but defense had already attempted to provide reenactment evidence to the jury, or later attempted to provide that reenactment evidence to the jury. Quite frankly, Mr. Garber's testimony would not have been helpful to the trier of fact, and I would ask this court to affirm the district court's exclusion of that expert testimony.
Was the alternative reenactment then not admitted because
It
of that
wasn't.
error?
It was admitted with instruction to the jury that they needed to take into consideration that the details of the reenactment weren't accurate. I do just want to very briefly touch on the supplemental document that the state provided, and thank you to the court for permitting that late response to defense's motion. It was offered in support of the lower court's decision. Defense counsel had the victim contact form before they submitted their request for a continuance, and there was no new information provided in that document. It was a witness contact form used as part of preparation for trial, and it basically just confirmed the information that the victim in this case had previously submitted to the court. As I just have a couple of minutes left, I do want to return to the first topic that I was discussing very briefly. As I noted before, Judge Hayne determined that Mr. Hart did not show remorse. And the important detail that I want to point out to the court is that after Judge Hayne says this may have been a perfect case for departure, after she says you could have taken a plea deal, instead we had a trial, she then says, quote, "I, along with you and everyone else, watched a video of the victim in the ambulance with a hole through his scrotum, screaming for his mother. Those are things you just can't unsee." End quote. Your Honors, I was present in the courtroom. I wasn't trial counsel, but I watched that exhibit. That's not just something that you can't unsee. That's something that you can't unhear. And despite seeing and hearing that exhibit, despite seeing and hearing the statement offered by the victim in this matter, who was 17 at sentencing, who told the court, "Sometimes I wish that Stephen Hart would have just kept pulling the trigger. I wish I would have died that day." When he was asked, "Do you have anything that you want to say to the court?" his response was no. I see that you've unmuted. That's why I've paused, Your Honor.
Well, I was just gonna, I mean, he has a right to not to offer an allocution, right? I mean, but I take your point that, in terms of whether he has a right to not offer an allocution and also show that there are compelling circumstances, to support his dispositional departure motion are two different things. I guess I have some concern about to along the same lines as Mr. McGinney's argument about holding his decision not to offer an allocution against him.
And it's not merely his decision not to offer an allocution. It's that his entire attitude, from my perspective, throughout his initial arrest, what was shown on the video of him in the back of a squad car, through him telling again that psychological evaluator, "I was attacked by someone who was homicidal." There just isn't any demonstration of remorse. The district court considered that to be a critical factor. And in considering all of the factors, determined that there were not substantial and compelling reasons for a dispositional departure. The court did not abuse its discretion, and the state requests the court affirm all of the lower court's decisions.
Any questions from the panel? All right, seeing no questions, thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you again. I'd like to start with the proposition from respondent that Mr. Hart's lack of remorse is dispositive in or is conclusive in his inability to be a candidate for a departure. And I would just point this court to its decision in Hickman, cited in my brief, where this court held that you can certainly grant a dispositional departure to an offender who doesn't show any remorse. And I think that is rightfully because, as we discussed at length in my primary argument, an offender who goes to trial and asserts their innocence may
I
not
mean,
ever show
you
remorse.
can do that, but you're not required to, right? The district court, your client received the guideline sentence. The district court didn't need to say anything, right? I mean, the district court could have just said, I've considered all of the arguments and I'm going to impose a guideline sentence. So I mean, that just because you can doesn't mean that you're required to. That doesn't show an abuse of discretion, right?
Oh, I agree. I think just that to rely on that in the argument that the district court didn't abuse its discretion in light of the district court's comments would show that the driving factor in the sentence imposed, and when I say the sentence, I don't mean the duration, I mean the disposition, the driving factor in the district court's imposition of an executed sentence was not Mr. Hart's lack of remorse. It was his choice not to resolve his case and take a plea deal. And again, that I believe that's intertwined. I think the record shows that's intertwined with the district court's determination that he wasn't remorseful because he went to trial, despite some of his statements at sentencing, his brief allocution, much shorter than his grandson's, and his statement on the psychological evaluation. So I just wanted to point Hickman out to this court that that's not necessarily a dispositive issue in granting a departure. The other thing briefly was that in the discussion about, the court's whether the court tipped its hand on whether Mr. Hart would get a departure if he did enter a plea agreement that was discussed with the respondent's attorney through questioning by this panel. This court has held that the district courts can't interject themselves on plea agreements, and it's inappropriate, reversible error actually, for a district court to tell a party what they would do if someone behaves a certain way, right? District courts are prohibited from revealing whether they'll grant a departure, at least on the record, whether you're going to grant a departure upon a plea or not. Unlike maybe 20 years ago, where district court judges all the time would advise defendants if they plead, you'll get a departure. That doesn't happen anymore, and it didn't happen in this case. So I don't know that the discussion about whether Judge Hayne tipped her hand to Mr. Hart that he would get a departure if he pleaded guilty. That didn't happen here, and it can't happen in these types of cases. The other thing I want to briefly discuss, I don't know that it's a major issue before this court, that victim contact sheet regarding the continuance request. But I want to point out that the district court summarily denied the continuance request through a judicial directive. I think the district court was on vacation the week before trial and remotely denied the continuance request. It wasn't really heard on the record. So the record doesn't really support counsel's contention that that document was considered a part of the reason that the district court denied the continuance. It's not even on the record that the district court actually saw that document or even had it when it decided. I guess it was in the record. It's in the record now somehow. No, it's not. So the district court, I didn't even know the district court had that document to consider it because that document's not in the record. So to say that that document was used in the district court's decision to deny the continuance request can't be true because the document's not part of the record. So, and again, the record is void of any thought process that Judge Hayne went through in denying Hart's attorney's request to continue the matter because of the late motion to exclude his expert. It was a summary denial through a notice of judicial directive. So I don't know that. I think that document should be stricken from this record. It wasn't part of the district court record. There's no indication that the district court ever had it or considered it in making its decision to deny the continuance request. And I understand that's the reason that it was included in the addendum, was in support of the respondent's argument that it was not abuse of discretion to deny the continuance request. I see I'm zeroed out. Unless the panel has more questions for me, I pass. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, counsel, for your helpful arguments. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe. That concludes our oral argument calendar this morning. Thank you all for attending. We are in recess.
Thank you, everybody. A belated Happy New Year to you all.